You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey, y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 20. As you probably know, the idea behind this podcast is to bring you the stories about the food, music, places, people, and events that make New Orleans unique. Today's guest manages to cover all five of those things. Since 1899, his family had its roots planted in the heart of New Orleans' 7th Ward, not far from the fairgrounds. My guest is the latest, but hopefully not the last, to continue his family's sausage-making tradition. His company is the last of the original food vendors at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, continuing the tradition begun by his late father, but that only begins to scratch the surface. He's also a family man, a performer with a beautiful voice, a student, and an ambassador of his Creole heritage. Welcome to the show, my friend and president of Vaucresson Sausage Company, Mr. Vance Vaucresson. How are you, man?
I'm fine, Mark. How are you doing?
Good. It's so nice to have you here. Yeah, as we were catching up before, for the listeners, Vance and I have a lot of shared history. We went to high school together.
Yes, yes. Go, Brother Martin.
There you go, the Crusaders back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. We also grew up in family businesses together. Not together, but we both have that shared experience. And I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. And I'm looking forward to diving into it.
Oh, well, to have the opportunity to speak on a lot of these topics, especially for a very diverse and educated audience, and be able to impart some knowledge about our culture and the different things that we have going on here, and especially my family's history and its contribution to the city, it's an honor.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to it. And before we jump in, I just want to point out the name of Vance's company is the Vaucresson Sausage Company. You can find them at VaucressonSausage.com, and you can email Vance at info@VaucressonSausage.com, and we'll make sure we post all that in the show notes afterwards, and we're going to talk about some other ways you can enjoy the products that you and your family produce. In fact, I should mention, we're sitting here at the little place called The Backyard on Harrison Avenue in Lakeview, and while I was waiting for Vance, I had a Vaucresson Sausage sandwich, so that was nice. Excellent as always, Vance.
Thank you.
So let's get started and talk about, I'd like to start with your family business. So Vaucresson Sausage Company is the present iteration of it, mm-hmm. right? And you're fourth generation, is that right?
Yeah, well, third. Okay. Third generation, yeah.
Okay.
My family, we dated back, we did a little research, and we found that as a family, we started in the meat business and butchering and making sausages right around 1899. My grandfather was a butcher by trade, Robert Levinsky Vaucresson, which is kind of a nod to the diverse ethnic culture and mixture of our ethnicity here in New Orleans, being that we're of the Creole heritage, which most people know is a mixture of French and Spanish and Caribbean, West African, Haitian, American Indian, and you find a mixture of these ethnicities, which along with the proximity of New Orleans and the port, you find that the Creole culture is truly the one true culture of New Orleans, and it encompasses such a mixture of races. I mean, in New Orleans, we have Caucasians and African Americans and people of mixed color who are a part of this culture.
Yeah, and I certainly want to jump into the Creole culture and the 7th Ward, sort of mm-hmm. the heart of it, right? We'll come to that. So your grandparents, and they were from the area of France in, like, Alsace, right? Alsace?
Yeah, actually, there's a town about maybe 9 miles west of Paris. It's called Vaucresson, France. And it was always largely a place kind of rustic and countryside. Beautiful, though. It's the name Vaucresson, it comes from anytime you have a name with S-O-N on the end, it's means the son of. So, like, if you see Richardson or anything with a son on the back, it means the son of. Well, Vaucre, when we did, the research on the word, it really is a nod to the fact that the area is full of all these beautiful little lakes and streams and things. So it kind of means the son of little rivers or little waters. And it was a town that was created by the monks of the Abbey of Saint-Denis, which sits outside of Aucresson. And the monks cleared the land for the town because the wooded area, a lot of people traveling through that area were getting robbed and beaten and taken for their possessions. So the monks, where the abbey is on a hill, the monks came down and cleared that area. And then people started to develop the town. And I think after the Roman occupation at that time, it kind of pretty much settled into the name of Aucresson. And it's a beautiful place. And my great-grandfather and my grandfather, especially my grandfather, was a butcher by trade. And he actually had a stall in the St. Bernard Market, which now is known as the Circle Food Store, on a corner of St. Bernard and Claiborne Avenue. And at the time, it was called the St. Bernard Market, which was an open market where different purveyors had vegetables, seafood, meats. And so you had various butchers that worked within this market. And a lot of times the people that worked in there, that had small stalls, were representations of what lived in the neighborhood at the time. And at the time in that neighborhood, you had a mixture of Italians and Irish and Creole people of color and Caucasians. And they lived harmoniously in this area. And then they also contributed to the landscape in regards to the food and the culture. And eventually, when the St. Bernard Market was bought out by a private person and made into the Circle, a lot of those individuals went off and opened their own places. And that's what my grandfather did. He opened his own meat market, Vaucresson's Meat Market, and basically provided fresh-cut meats. It was somewhat of like a mini grocery store. He had produce and other items you needed, but main thing was the butcher stall, where you could get all your meats and your seven steaks and your pork chops. And as any butcher does, when they're trimming out all of those sides of meat and all those portion cuts, you're going to have trimmings left. And, you know, you have to use everything in order to make that bottom line really work for you. So that's where sausage and the use of sausage with a lot of butchers comes in, because they can make stuff that can stretch in terms of the bottom line. And so we made our Creole hot sausage and chorizo, which is a Creole form of hot sausage. And we just built a reputation for having a very good product, and it contributed to the neighborhood flavor. And it wasn't until probably when my dad took over after my grandfather died. He was in college. He quit, came back, and started working in the business with his brother-in-law, who was a butcher and was running it. And my dad was a little different than my grandfather's. He had that fiery spirit of entrepreneurship. He just didn't want to just sit and be a butcher behind a counter. So he let his brother-in-law run the meat market. And then in the area, he went into business with his other brother-in-law, who had a liquor store. So he had a liquor store, and he had the meat market. And then my dad was very active in the French Quarter and with the people that ran it and that owned a lot of property. A lot of people don't know there were about three families at one time that really ran the Quarter property and business-wise. And that was the Carnot family, you had the Caracci family, and you had the Kahn family. And my dad was pretty much good terms with all of them. And this was in the mid-60s. And one of his good friends at the time was a guy named Larry Bornstein. And Larry Bornstein is known as the founder of Preservation Hall. And he was an art dealer. And he owned a building, the Fontaine House, at 624 Bourbon Street. And he and my dad started talking. And I guess they realized he didn't have any really good, authentic Creole cooking represented in the French Quarter. Because a lot of the people that did the cooking in a lot of the perennial great restaurants in the Quarter, Galatoire's and Antoine's and Arnaud's and Broussard's and all the other ones, were people of color. But none had any ownership or really, promoted that type of food in that area at that time. So he went ahead and got into the restaurant business with Larry, and they opened up Vogelsong's Cafe Creole in the late 60s. And it was met with, obviously, once the word got out that a man of color was going to have ownership, it was met with a lot of backlash. And my, but the three families that really had the say, they knew my dad. They knew him as Sonny. Now, my dad, what you got to realize, was a very fair-skinned man, light blue eyes. There was nothing when you looked at him that made you think he was a man of color. And so people went about, and he went about, he never passed, which is a term called passe blanc, which within the Creole community, you had some that they were so fair in their mixture of ethnicity that they would pass for white. My dad never did that. My dad always told me, he says, I never passed, but if I went about and did my business, and if you assumed, but you did business with me because of my content, of my character, and because of my ability, then we're going to do business. And so he went about and opened the restaurant, and even with the backlash, we had it for about 9 years. Only thing that probably killed it was the fact that the quarter itself was changing, and it was changing to a place where it wasn't as good of a place for restaurant survival if you weren't one of the big boys. So we, you know, sold it, and it became Cafe Creole, and then eventually Pat O'Brien's bought the building from Borenstein, and now he has the Annex Bar. So when you come to New Orleans and you go to the Pat O'Brien's Annex Bar at 624 Bourbon, know you're in the old Vogelsong's Cafe Creole.
That's a great story. And as you're talking, it made me realize you and I have even more in common. So as you know, my last name is Bologna, so Sicilian. But my family, where Teddy's Grill is, it was a butcher shop first. And Mr. Teddy, same thing. He had the trimmings. He had to do something with it. He started selling some groceries. He started selling sandwiches. And by the time my dad started working there as a teenager, that part of the business was growing up, and the butcher side was phasing out, mm-hmm. and obviously the po'boy place took over. But it was that same thing, that combination. You talked about 7th Ward, right? So in the heart of the city, right in the area of Mid-City and Gentilly, kind of the next neighborhood over where I grew up, same thing, very mixed in terms of all the ethnicities you just described. Mm-hmm. Kind of the same deal. My family had a liquor distributor and a wine bottling company, mm-hmm. so it's interesting, mm-hmm. right? People think they're so different, and the history and the legacy in New Orleans is so intertwined.
It is. And I think that, you know, especially nowadays, if people just knew their history and knew the culture and how diverse this particular society in New Orleans was and still is, we could probably really shed some light in terms of how people from different ethnic backgrounds could really get along and work harmoniously for the better of their city.
And it's one of the things that I love about your story. Obviously, we have this shared history and shared Brother Martin history, but you guys, it seems like your whole family, and certainly you've continued it, has tried very hard to blend all those things you just described. Mm-hmm. Our collective fit in the city, crossing ethnic lines and racial lines, the food, and I think all that comes across. So I know you and I were talking over the weekend. You just did this thing at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum over the mm-hmm. weekend, right? Mm-hmm. Which was, I'd like you to talk a little bit about that. But that was sort of a combination of the Gullah culture in South Carolina with the Creole culture. Is that right?
Right. It was a forum was done by Dr. Howard Conyers, and here another person who, he's a rocket scientist that works for NASA. But he grew up in South Carolina doing whole hog smoking, and it's a passion of his. And he moved to New Orleans working with the NASA plant down in Michoud, but fell in love with the city and its food, and felt he could contribute because he knew that the Gullah culture in South Carolina, the coastal people that lived on that area, and the foods that they produced were West African influenced, and that in the Creole culture, a lot of the dishes that we've had, and especially around here by the port and by the water, they're very similar in nature. They have rice dishes that are similar to jambalaya. They have other dishes, stews that are very similar to gumbo, and the use of the different seafoods and things from the coast and how they use them are very similar. So he started this program called From the Low Country to the Bayou, the shared experiences of the Gullah and the Creole traditions. And so he brought some people, he brought a chef, BJ Dennis from South Carolina, to come and cook some of the foods from the Gullah Geechee traditions. I made some boudin and some Creole sausages and spoke on a lot of the different cultural aspects of Creole in regards to the city, its history, and then how it relates to the Gullah traditions. And then he had some other artists and people that came from South Carolina that spoke on Gullah and performed Gullah music. So it was, and we had a lady, Barbara Trevine, who was a historian, Creole historian, and she made kalas, which there's a group called Slow Food USA, who they have certain foods that they are watching that are just trying to promote and prevent from extinction. And you have chorizo and kalas are on that list. And so to have them made and for people to taste them is just it's a joy, because you can expand someone's knowledge of something that is truly cemented within the culture of New Orleans history.
And people tend to think that we're so different, right? And that's a great example. The two cultures, two different parts of the country, and really a lot of overlap, a lot of similarity, yes, and shared experience.
Yes, it is. And all it takes is for people just to sit down and just talk and share their experiences. You will be amazed on the similarities and how relatable it is and how, you know, you're just not that different.
And that's kind of a nice segue. I want to talk a little bit about Jazz Fest. Mm-hmm. And I think, from my lens, Jazz Fest at its best is about community. The music's great, the food's great, and I want to talk about that. But I almost feel like it's an invitation to share those things with people you might not be with the rest of the year. But mm-hmm. you come together over a Vokersong's hot sausage po' boy, sitting in front, maybe at the Economy Jazz tent or the Blues tent, right? Or even one of the big stages, and you got something in common, and you're sitting next to a neighbor you don't know, and by the end of the day, you're friends.
Mm-hmm.
So how is it that your dad came to be involved with Jazz Fest?
Well, the thing was, and it takes us back to the restaurant on Bourbon Street. Larry Bornstein was a good friend of George Ween, the founder of the Jazz and Heritage Festival. And at the time, George was doing the Newport News Jazz Festival, which predates the Jazz and Heritage Festival. And he had just come back from doing it, and he was in the restaurant, and he was talking to Larry. Now, at the table, it was Larry Bornstein, it was George Ween, my dad, Sonny Vokersong, and a young tuba player from Michigan that was helping Larry run Preservation Hall by the name of Alan Jaffe. So they were at the table, and they were just kind of talking about Newport News and what was going on. And the conversation kind of took a turn as to asking George, why doesn't New Orleans, the birthplace of jazz, have its own festival which celebrates the origin and the culture and everything else? And it was kind of just a conversation, brainstorming session about what they could do and this, that, and the other. And I really feel, from what my dad told me, the oral history of it, that George left that meeting, that day in the restaurant, and started to put together the concept for what became the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, even soliciting this long-haired record store manager to come on board and help him to run it by the name of Quint Davis. So, and at that meeting, they said, well, Sonny, why don't you go ahead and we need food, so you can sell food at the festival. So, you know, when it started, we had a booth. We opened up a booth, and we had the restaurant still. So what we would do is make the sandwiches at the restaurant, wrap them in foil, and bring them to the booth, and then sell them out the booth. Now, I was at the festival for a period of time. I was 6 months old. My mom had to watch the booth at the fest because my dad was at the restaurant. So when I tell people I'm 48 years old and I was at the first festival, they look at me, they say, well, the festival's only going to be 40. I mean, it's 47, 48 years old. How were you there? I said, well, my mom had to watch me, and she brought me there. So I count that as the first day I smelled it. I heard it. You know, I may not have tasted it, but, you know, they did feed sausage to me before I was one. So sure. I probably did. But it and then from there, like they told me, you know, the first festival was probably, they had more musicians there than they actually had people. But, you know, my dad was like, you know, there's something about this. There's something special about this. And because of his association with the people that ran it, he always gravitated back to it. He saw it as a good, you know, something to go into and participate in. And even though, you know, the people don't realize, within the first 2 years, they moved to the Jazz Fair, to the French Fairgrounds. And you know, my mother and dad worked the booth, and they used to always say how it was not a moneymaker. It was, you know, they would have a party if they broke even, and there maybe 5-6 booths at the first few festivals, but eventually it grew, and you know, the Jazz Fest took a turn once national media started to take notice. But when the media writers were writing, it wasn't so much because of the music and the culture, which was very much, you know, right in the forefront. But they started writing about the food and how impressive and how good it was and how it was like nothing they had ever tasted. And as that momentum grew, I remember around 1976, Mimi Sheridan, who was the famed food critic for the New York Times, came down. And they did this thing called the Food Olympics. And they basically judged all the food vendors at the festival. And we were fortunate enough that year to win Best Food at Fest. And Mimi went back and was writing about, you know, there's this festival in New Orleans that, you know, it's great for music and for culture. But what makes it is this food. And even the organizers of the Jazz and Heritage Festival have to admit that the success of this festival is largely in part because of the food and the high level of what they have placed on it in regards to importance and how much they want it to be the highest quality as possible. And because of the Jazz and Heritage Festival, I think that you now have the saturation in the city of all these different festival events. I mean, there's a festival almost every weekend, and a lot of that is because, you know, Jazz Fest had the vision to provide this type of entity and stick with it, because it had some lean years. They didn't always were successful with it, but they stuck with it. And then as it grew and it kept growing and it got to a point where it was like, we're just amazed after all this time. One, that we're still in it. You know, to be in something for 47 years, you know, we're still shaking our head like, why would we do this to ourselves? But, you know, I went away to college. I came back. My folks said, you take it over. We're finished. And you keep it going. And I've been keeping it going for the last maybe 25 years. And, you know, you see the importance of it because you see people that come to town for this festival. They come to your booth to get your food, but they also come to see you, because they've gotten to bond with you and establish a rapport. They get to talk with you. They get to really feel the true essence of, like we talked about before, the people of New Orleans and how special they are and how diverse they are and how much you can really learn from what maybe is not what's available in other parts of the country. So the Jazz and Heritage Festival is truly should be noted as the creator and the grandfather, the godfather of all of this conceptually, because it proved that it could work. Now, a few years ago, they were bought into by a large producer, AEG, and AEG obviously has lifted it up to new heights, made it comparable to a destination festival like Bonnaroo and Coachella. And some of the locals and people that have participated, we're fighting to make sure that the heritage and the culture part of that name, the Jazz and Heritage Festival, stays apart. We know that the board of directors is very much adamant about keeping that apart and keeping it, in essence, what it's always been. And we're thankful for that.
Well, and I think there's a bunch to unpack there. To your point, as a local, there has been a big push about let's preserve the jazz and the economy hall stages and the gospel tent and local musicians of all kinds of genres that are local, right? Our friend Paul Sanchez, who we'll talk about in a bit, John Boutte. But I've always thought growing up in New Orleans, one, I was just very fortunate, very blessed. But then to grow up either in a restaurant family or a music family, I think is a whole other level in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And you sort of got to do both. You know, and your point, we experienced the same thing. People would come back for our food, but it was that connection with you. Mm-hmm. You know, the connection with your family and watching, probably like you, watching me grow up from diapers in the back of the place to, you know, to an adult. And then seeing your kids and my kids and... You know, I think that really ties back to that importance about culture, and that's what makes New Orleans so special to me.
Yeah, yeah.
I also think that the point you make about Jazz Fest, there's great music festivals all over the country, but my experience is most of them have sort of fairgrounds kind of food, right? State fair kind of food, which is fine, but that's not the case here. And if you went to a festival in New Orleans and you got state fair kind of food, it wouldn't go over well.
No. We have, you know, because of our culture and and what we know as a staple of good food. You know, the locals would run us out of there because, I mean, where you go to a festival and you can get crawfish monica and soft shell crab po' boys, and you can get oyster sacks and great dishes that really you're not going to get anywhere else. And it's what's made that festival what it is. And we feel very strongly about it, not only as vendors, but as locals, that you get people that say, you know, man, I wouldn't go to the Jazz Fest, but I got to come get my food, you know. And it really is, it humbles us because, you know, we work very hard to be in that same place every year. We're thankful that we're still here. Nothing's happened to us. And to continue to provide people with what they're looking for, which is, you know, some semblance of that tradition, semblance of what has always been, that gets them a tie to the authenticity and to the real history of what has made it what it is. And we're just thankful to have been a part of that.
Well, and even as a New Orleanian who's been going to Jazz Fest my whole life, I love the music. But the acts come and go every year, right? Mm. But you walk in, my wife laughs at me, I walk in, and an hour and a half after I'm in, I've had five things, right? I've had a hot sausage po' boy and some crawfish monica and some crawfish bread. And she's like, come on, baby, slow down. It's a long day. But it is, even for a local, it's that tradition, right? It's that, this is like Mardi Gras being on the same corner every year on Mardi Gras Day, right? This is what Jazz Fest is to me. And the music is great, don't get me wrong, but it's almost the accoutrement of the food for me, and I think for a lot of people, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then especially since, you know, after Hurricane Katrina, you know, Hurricane Katrina for us, it really just wiped the slate clean. And with the way the city has changed and grown and been rebuilt, a lot of people who maybe were not natives or saw an interest or an opportunity in New Orleans came down. And like most people, once you come down here, you're going to fall in love. You're not going to know why immediately, but you're going to realize that I can't leave here. I got to move here. And a lot of people move here from different places, and they just soak in the culture. They soak in the heritage and become citizens of the city. But we've got to be careful, because in a lot of examples where you have such development, and this was one that was not seen in history. I mean, the total city could be rewritten overnight. And so, you know, along with gentrification and along with the changes needed in order to hopefully make it a city to compete in the 21st century, some things have the potential of being lost, and that's our culture and our traditions. And a lot of us are trying to make sure that even within the neighborhoods in which we existed, that we try to maintain a presence so that we can be stakeholders and provide the oral history, educate people as to this area and what it meant historically, and just hopefully be able to pass that on so that, you know, it doesn't get manufactured, or some people try to make assumptions as to what this was about and what certain things are. And I think that's important because, you know, nowadays we see our younger generations just are not in tune to some of the things that are so meaningful to us, you know, and we're just hoping that they grasp a hold of them and really take them to heart and cherish them, and so that they can truly know that when they have kids, how beautiful it is to pass something down like that. Yeah. You know?
And so your family business was in the 7th Ward, right? And obviously it was wiped out in Katrina.
Yeah, we got hit hard after Katrina. And you know, like a lot of small businesses, you don't always prepare for crisis management. It's not like you have meetings about that. And you think, well, my insurance will take care of it, or this, that, and the other. But this was such a unique storm, a unique catastrophe, that in my pursuit to try to come back, it was met with so many obstacles. I know the first one was I just had to get out of the city because didn't have a place to live. So I lived in New Iberia, Louisiana for about 2 years, and had my mother-in-law, her neighbor, my aunt. I had all these people that evacuated with me. And so you have to take care of them, and then you have to help to get them back into their homes. And eventually, one by one, we got either the homes rebuilt or repaired. And then eventually we got back, but then the business needed to come back. And as you move forward, you realize, you know, from an insurance standpoint, I didn't have the coverage that truly would make me whole. I had flood insurance, but it wasn't enough. All the other insurances had flood exclusions, so you couldn't get anything out of that. And then when you are in a family business where you have multiple heirs that have significant investment or shares, you run into the same type of situation that most people may deal with when you have a matriarch or a patriarch when they die and they have all these siblings, where they normally would get along. But when it comes to the selling of the estate, a lot of people you find out think differently. And sometimes it could cause siblings and heirs to turn on themselves. Well, in my particular case, it wasn't so much that as it was trying to get other members to see the same vision or be willing to invest into the same rebuild. And that wasn't the case. So without certain participation, I couldn't have certain resources available to me. And I also had my wife got sick during the storm and had like 5 surgeries in a year and a half. And I had a newborn child. And, you know, it was a lot more peripheral things that kept me from putting all my efforts back into it. But I got a call. I was in New Iberia. I got a call. Jazz Fest people found me and they said, look, we're about to put the festival back on. Can you do it? And I said, well, I don't even have a place to make sausage, but let me see if I can find a way. And I contacted a local man who was in Metairie, and he had much damage to his building, but he had gotten back up and running. And we knew each other as competitors. And I approached him with the idea of possibly letting me come in and make the sausage using his equipment. And he did. And from there, we've maintained a relationship because we saw the value in each other's businesses and what we did. And I'm so thankful for him. And it puts in perspective, you know, the opportunity of hope that you can work with people and make things happen, especially out of such gruesome circumstances. And then just coming back, you know, you realize the small business, you know, if you got to have certain resources, you got to have, you know, my whole crew moved away. And then one of my office manager, who was a key component of business, was depressed and committed suicide. So you got all these factors, especially with small business. You can't absorb like some major corporations, just replace somebody, have the lines of credit and equity to keep moving. It just wasn't the case, but we just didn't give up. And the way I could keep my business out there and my product out there was to keep doing our festivals. So we're in a lot of festivals since Jazz Fest. We're an original vendor in the French Quarter Festival, which is a large festival now. We do a number of festivals throughout the calendar year. We do Po' Boy Festival in November. We do Blues and Barbecue in October. We do Satchmo Fest in August. We do, I know there's a couple of them I can't remember, but it's now become where it was only 2 months of the year where you would have festivals. Now you have festivals all the way through to November.
Yeah, and they're adding them all the time.
Yes.
And you jumped right in. You took care of my business as a host. I was going to point out part of the reason I wanted to do this now is because you got the Blues and Barbecue Festival coming up, and then right on the heels, in November, you got the Po' Boy Festival in the Carrollton area. I'm actually going to do a podcast about that area coming up. But right, it seems like you can't have a festival these days without Volkerson sausage.
Well, I hope the organizers feel that way and keep calling.
And I know as a fan and certainly as a New Orleanian, it's great to see it. And obviously people can come to places like where we're sitting now, a place called The Backyard, and have your product, have the sausage sandwich. But that's a great way to continue it all throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you and I were talking before that right now people can't buy from you directly. Mm-hmm. So those festivals are a great way. And I would certainly encourage, I know there's a big group of listeners coming in town for the Blues and Barbecue Festival. They've been asking me for suggestions. And that's one of the things I said, look, here's the list of vendors you need to go check out. But Volkerson's is going to be right there on the square.
We thank you for that. And it was, you know, a lot of these festivals, they'll start up and we just take a chance with them because some of them, they don't work. They're not, some festivals started and, you know, there's a certain mix of variables that you need to have these festivals be successful. And, you know, we've been doing it so long, we can pretty much figure out which ones will work over time or not. And, you know, some of these we took chances on and they just wound up being, you know, really good successes and allowed us to stay in there and watch them have waiting lists to get in and have grown to where, you know, even the booth fees are somewhat exorbitant, but it's because you're going to do the business. And, you know, I'm just thankful that, you know, I, even with all of the frustration and all of the doubt and all of the issues personally I had, which caused me to, as a lot of people, you know, sometimes when you're dealing with multi-generational businesses, when the next generation is up, doesn't always mean that next generation wants that vision. You know, usually it's the previous generation's vision. And then when the next generation comes up, based on the success of that generation past, they could have provided a great education, a lot of more other options and opportunities for their offspring. And so when it's time to look at the continuance of the business, it's not always considered, especially in my case where I had two older brothers. My oldest brother wanted to be an opera singer and pursued music. He worked in the business when he wasn't singing or touring, but it wasn't what he would have wanted to do. But he did it until his untimely death when he was about 33 years old. And then my other brother, we all worked in the business, but he just had no desire to, it just wasn't his thing, you know. And then for me, I was always extremely loyal to my parents for all they did. And as the baby, you always want to impress them and make them happy. So I found myself doing whatever I could to make them happy. And my dad asked me to come back to the business, and I did. And, you know, I wanted to because it was a family business, and I wanted to work with my dad. I wanted to do it with my dad because he was always working. He wasn't home. So now I have an opportunity to have him to myself, and I had him for 7 wonderful years. And if we didn't fight every day at work, fussing about something ideologically in terms of how to do whatever job we were doing or make the sausage any particular way, then I knew we didn't love each other. Because if we fought, we knew we were very much in love with, you know, being family and being a part of this tradition. And then he passed in 98, and it was left up to me. And then when he was gone, and then especially after the storm, when you realize that really it's just me and I have to make this happen and make this work, you know, I'm not gonna lie, you don't have doubt, you know, and you get frustrated and you wonder about what other opportunities you could have. But in the rebuild of the city, New Orleans, and the overall desire for traditions to be maintained and for a culture to be reinvigorated and reestablished, it only made sense for me to continue this tradition and rebuild this business and in hopes that it carries on, whether my sons and daughter wish to do it or not. You know, it will be something that we will try to continue to have in existence so that people can continue to enjoy our product and also get a little bit of that culture when they come see us.
Do any of the kids have any interest in it yet?
You know, actually, I took a different approach than my dad. You know, my dad had us in there at young. You know, you had to clean up. You had to do all this other stuff. And, you know, it's not something that you were given an option. Whereas with my kids, I started off in the beginning. I said, look, I want you to help me, and I'll pay you, which was something my dad never did. And I'd pay you, but I want you to know that, you know, if you want to do this, it's got to be something you want to do. If by the time that you're of age to decide, if what I've done has not been that great of an influence, I respect that. You know, I mean, we can always get somebody to run it. You just hold your shares and get a cut. But other than that, it's just, you know, I think that my approach with my kids, if I can just have them to just learn the traditions, learn, you know, how to do it, maybe one of them may say, hey, you know, I want to work alongside my dad this time. So we'll see.
And I think that's something people that aren't in family business don't understand, because my upbringing was like yours. The way I got to spend time with my dad was working in the restaurant. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want, now in our house, when you were 11, you had to go down and work. That was the rule. And same thing, cleaning toilets was the first job. And but I quickly learned that the best way to spend time with my father, one-on-one time, was those early mornings and those late nights in the place. You know, and like you said, that time's invaluable, right? So that's great to hear.
It is.
Yeah. I want to kind of move on just a little bit and talk about one of the other many traditions in your family and in the 7th Ward is a music tradition. And I remember, so again, Vance and I went to high school together, and I remember going to track meets and being in the bus, and those of you that were in chorus were singing a cappella in the back. You know, I have lots of memories of high school, but I think of that sometimes, and just the joy in doing that. You know, and sometimes you think, oh, we went to an all-boys school, and there's this macho thing about it, and here you are, a bunch of guys in the bus just hanging out and enjoying being together and singing together. And as you and I have grown up, music has always been close to you. In fact, my mother and father used to go to the same Catholic church that you and your family went to before the storm, and she would always talk about you singing in the choir. But as I was doing the research, I realized another thing. I knew that about you. I did not realize that you were related to the wonderful music family in New Orleans, the Boutés. So they're cousins, right? Is that
yeah,
your relationship
that's
with
my
John?
Cousins. That's on my dad's side. The musical influence actually comes from both sides. My grandfather on my mother's side was a banjo player for the Sam Morgan Jazz Band, which was a recorded jazz band of musicians. And he, played banjo. And actually his banjo was in the old U.S. Mint State Museum at one point. And then on my dad's side, the Boutés, they're related on my grandmother's side. Growing up and knowing them, they're a very musical family. And John Boutte, as well as Lillian Boutte, went on and really made a name for themselves, more so in Europe. For Lillian, she left a long time ago and really lived in Germany for over 30 years and just toured Europe and toured different continents and built that brand. And then John came along and did some of that as well. But then he went on and found success more recently with the series Tremé on HBO, and the lead song is his song, the Tremé song, which became a hit for him and elevated his career and stature. So, and then the next generation after them, Sister Titi, Trisha Boutte, she lives in Norway and continues the traditions of music. Arsène Delay, which is another niece, she's in the Bayou Saints and has her own groups and sings around the city. And then Tanya Boutte, which is another performer that's performed in Europe with Lillian and performed in the French Quarter for years and is now relaunching her music career, following behind Lillian's traditions of performing traditional New Orleans music. And myself, I grew up singing with them. And then when I went to college, I sang in the glee club, took voice, because my oldest brother was an opera singer, so I wanted to explore that and the influence that he placed upon me. And then I came back, and I just, when you are a musician, it doesn't matter what you do, you still got to do your music. So through all of this, I always found outlets to do my music. And one of the most consistent ones was I always sang in church, because I always felt that, if God gives you this gift, the first thing you need to do with it is give it back to him. So I always sang in church and did worship liturgy. And then in time, would do, sang studio backgrounds for the Boutés when they would record. Even met Paul Sanchez through John when they were working on music, and I wound up writing a song with Paul that he recorded. And then when he started to go into other things, he never forgot about me.
And that's a great segue. So I assume where you're going with that is Nine Lives, mm-hmm. In part. So the Dan Baum book, post-Katrina, if you haven't read it, you certainly ought to go get it. It talks about nine different people and nine different perspectives coming back post-Katrina. But our mutual friend Paul Sanchez, with some others, basically converted that into sort of a musical play or a rendition of the book, right?
Yeah, he and a guy named Coleman DK took the concept of the book and wrote 40 songs and created a two-disc album with the intent to hopefully see if they could make it into a musical. They solicited and received a grant from Pepsi Cola to record it. And so in the process, he called and said, "Look, Vance, I need you. Can you come do some background vocals?" And I said, "Sure." So went into Piety Street Studios, Mark Bingham's famous studio on Piety Street, and laid some background tracks and vocals and left. And then he'd call me later and say, "Man, can you come do some more?" And so I'd go back, sing whatever he told me to sing, and I leave. And then one time he called me and he said, "Look, I've got some other songs that I've written. Could you do the lead on them?" And so I said, "Sure." And there were two of them were duets and another one was a single solo. So I did those. And he was happy because I worked fast in the studio, because studio time is precious. So, you go in, you do it, and you get out. And they always want you back. And so after it was finished, they wanted to take it to the next level of seeing if they could get the Broadway community interested in seeing it as a concept for a musical. So we started staging it, just doing concert type performances. We'd stand in front of a mic and just kind of sing the songs, with the liberties given to us to kind of interpret them as we see fit. So some of the songs that I was in, I mean, these are New Orleans songs, Buck Jump songs. Well, you know, I started dancing and buck jumping on stage. And so, you know, Paul was like, well, whatever you're doing, keep doing it, because, you know, it adds to it. So I just kept coming back every time he wanted to do some type of performance of it. And then eventually the Public Theater of New York got wind of it, sent some of the board of directors down. They watched it. They saw, they liked it. And then they came back with the whole board and the artistic director. And they were so interested in it that eventually they rounded up some investors who invested in the project. And now we're at the place where we're workshopping it, trying to develop a final script of it and final vision of it. And hopefully one day we'll see it possibly be off Broadway or on Broadway or in some way produced so that people can see this wonderful story come out to life.
I think, one, the performances are terrific, but it encapsulates so much of what you've spent this discussion talking about. You have people from different backgrounds and different ethnicities, but the common thing is a love of New Orleans, a love of story, the music, and the people involved in that. It's such a wonderful composite of so many good musicians in the city.
It is, and even some that are not from here, that, you know, they fall in love with the city. As we were doing the show, one person who became very interested in it, and who is also a part resident now that he's bought a home here, is Michael Cerveris, who is a two-time Tony Award-winning actor. He won for Assassins and for Fun Home, and he is actually an investor, and he's the one that has taken the lead in trying to see this come to fruition on the stage in New York. And we've also had other performers, like Wendell Pierce was on the recording. Clark Peters, who was on Treme, was also performed it. We even had Harry Shearer to do performances on it. And Brian Batt, who was with AMC's Mad Men. A number of wonderful performers who, when you get into the room with them and you get into rehearsals with them, even with all that they've accomplished and what they've achieved, are some of the most down-to-earth and wonderful people to perform with, and who even acknowledge you for the talents that you bring to the table. And it's humbling, and it also shows you that all these people from these various backgrounds can come together and truly perform a work that we feel is monumental when it comes to the history of New Orleans.
Yeah, it's truly amazing, and one of the things that strikes me too is, when you take John and Paul, those are two guys that just have a way of, they approach people and people don't say no. And
yes,
they have a way of pulling people together from all different backgrounds and resources, and they just are glue, right? And it feels to me like Nine Lives and the production and what you all have been able to do with it is really a reflection of that, pulling the community back together and sharing this love and trying to spread it, right? Mm-hmm. And you mentioned lots of people that aren't from here. I sort of think that you're either born New Orleanian or you're New Orleanian, you just don't know it yet.
Right, right.
We just got to get you down here.
Exactly. You have people who come here, and once they just get a feel for, I guess, the bohemian nature of the city, you know, it's not pretentious. It's not, it moves along at its own pace. And it's really, once you know, if you're a fan of music, if you're a fan of art, if you're a fan of history, if you're a fan of the varied looking people in the city, and then once you start talking to them and taking it in, you realize there's no way you can go back home to this homogeneous lifestyle where you may just eat a certain type of food, get a certain type of music, and a certain type of exposure to culture. It's something that you just, it grows in you. It won't let you go until you finally come back and say hello.
And that's a great way to wrap it up. I want to mention before we close out again, you can find out information about Vance and his company over at VocalSongSausage.com. Probably the best way to check out what you guys do is to go to the festivals and look for VocalSongSausage. Again, we're in a place called Backyard on Harrison Avenue, one of many places that sells your products. As you mentioned, please check out, if you haven't read the book, Nine Lives, certainly do that. It's a good base. But go online and look for some of the videos. You can find them on YouTube, some of the performances, and we'll link to some of them in the show notes. But also, that's something when you come in town, check and see if there's a performance. And certainly, as the production continues to grow, and as you talked about, get the funding, it's such a marvelous. It brings those stories to life, and what you guys have done have added to it so much, and just made it so personal. Mm-hmm. It was a great book, but it's a wonderful production, and it's a great way to learn in a couple hours performance a lot of the culture and history of New Orleans. And we could go on and on. The Backstreet Cultural Museum and Ronald Lewis over at the House of Dance and Feathers is featured in it. And anyway, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time and for sharing your story with us.
My pleasure, Mark. My pleasure. You know, I think what you're doing is wonderful, and to have another resource for people to learn and hear and just get a taste of New Orleans. I'm sure a lot of your listeners, once they really get into your different podcasts and soak it in, it's undeniable as to not if they're coming to visit, but when. And then I'm going to warn you, if you come down here and you get a little taste of it, don't be surprised if you're not an annual visitor or even now a new resident.
I have this theory that it's the humidity, right? And it seeps in your pores. And once it gets in there, maybe you can't get that out.
No. It's like nothing is, it's so unique. Its exposure will make you have to get a little bit more. After a while, you just got to have a little taste. So it may be just visiting Jazz Fest once a year. It may be coming for New Year's or coming for Mardi Gras. Whatever it is, you'll find that from that first visit, you'll wake up one day and be like, I now have annual tradition of coming to this city. And eventually you're going to go ahead and just say, okay, I'm just going to go ahead and look for something, place to live, see if I can put some roots down there.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Vance, and thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Vance and the opportunity to learn about the history of his family's business. We also heard the inside scoop about the beginnings of Jazz Fest, and you got a behind-the-scenes look into the music of Nine Lives. By the way, if you ever get the chance to see Paul Sanchez live or any of the Boutif family, do it. It'll be a great experience, I promise. As we mentioned during the show, check out Vaucresson Sausage at many of the festivals in New Orleans, including Barbecue and Blues from October 14th to 16th this year, and the Po' Boy Festival a week later on October 23rd. And of course, a Vaucresson Sausage Po' Boy should be on your gotta-have list at Jazz Fest each year. You can find the notes for today's show on our website over at beyondbourbonst.com/20, and you can find Vance at vaucressonsausage.com. Thanks so much for listening, y'all, and a special thanks, of course, to Vance Vaucresson for joining me on the podcast. If you want to hear more shows like this one, please subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. If you have an idea for a future show, or you just want to reach out to me, my email is mark@beyondbourbonst.com. We love doing the show and hope you love it too. If you do, please tell others about Beyond Bourbon Street. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. We're working on future stories about the HBO series Tremé, the Riverbend area of the city, the cemeteries of New Orleans, and A Girl's Guide to the Crescent City, plus many more. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.